John chapter 12, please. John chapter 12, and also Isaiah chapter 1. We'll begin in John 12 and then go over to Isaiah for the balance. But before I begin, just something a little lighthearted. Maybe we need that right now. This is God's plan for aging. It's in large type, too. It says, most seniors never get enough exercise. In his wisdom, God decreed that seniors become forgetful, so they would have to search for their glasses, keys, and other things, thus doing more walking. And God looked down and saw that it was good. Then God saw there was another need. In his wisdom, he made seniors lose coordination, so they drop things, requiring them to bend, reach, and stretch. And God looked down and saw that it was good. Then God considered the function of bladders and decided seniors would have additional calls of nature requiring more steps to the bathroom, thus providing more exercise. And God looked down and saw that it was good. I'm not going to give all nine, but some important things to remember as we grow older. Death is the number one killer in the world. Life is sexually transmitted. Good health is merely the slowest possible rate at which one can die. Men have two motivations, hunger and hanky-panky, and they can't tell them apart. If you see a gleam in his eyes, make him a sandwich. Health nuts are going to feel stupid someday. Lying in a hospital bed, dying of nothing. In the 60s, people took LSD to make the world weird. Now the world is weird and people take Prozac to make it normal. And number one, life is like a jar of jalapeno peppers. What you do today may be a burning issue tomorrow. That aside, what's next for America? Tuesday we elect the 45th president in the 58th presidential election. 227 years since George Washington became our first president. I dare say that we are experiencing probably one of the, at least in my lifetime, a period of the greatest division and unrest. I can't speak for out of that, but that's saying a lot. I graduated from high school in 1970, the middle of the Vietnam era. 1968, both Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy were assassinated. There were the race riots. There were the protests against the Vietnam War. 1969 was the famous Woodstock concert, not far from, about an hour and a half, 2 hours from where I grew up in Woodstock, New York. And then in 1970, just a little over a month before I graduated from high school, was the protest at Kent State University, and four were killed. And you think about all of that unrest and that turmoil. And I was thinking about that this week, and the song of the Beatles came to mind, Revolution. You say there's going to be a revolution. Oh, yeah, you know. We're going to change the world. And it's those of my generation that experienced all this turmoil. And it was fostered in the college campuses and through the music of the day, much of which came out of Woodstock, all the protests that were there. And I mean, when I went to college, just a year after Woodstock, the album that was produced, the live concert, was played throughout the dorm rooms. And all those protest songs and all those cries for revolution and anarchy were what we were fed while I was in college. And I was thinking about what we're experiencing now, what we're seeing taking place now. And it appears to me that it's simply the fruit of the seeds that were planted back in the 60s. This is a difficult time. Now, I don't claim any special insight, any prophetical understanding of things. I'm just going to give some observations. But you watch this stuff, and you see what's going on now with the killing of police officers and the riots that are taking place in various places. And I'm not, in my lifetime at least, I think it even exceeds what was taking place back in the 60s. As we go to the polls on Tuesday, we need to think about what we're doing. I think it's important to go. And I think it's more important than just the candidate that we are voting for. It's the principles for which that candidate and the party which they represent stands for. There's a dramatic difference. I know Donald Trump is a scumbag personally. I'm not supporting Donald Trump. I'm supporting some of the things he said he would stand for. Is he going to follow through? I don't know. But I know she will. And you can cast a conscience vote if you want. But a lot of people did that the last time. And we re-elected Barack Obama. And my opinion, for what it's worth, Hillary Clinton is no Barack Obama. She's worse. And there's a lot of issues that are at stake. I want you to go now to John chapter 12. And we're going to begin reading in verse 23. And I'm going to just make some comments as we go through here. And then I want to go back to Isaiah chapter 1. But as we look at John chapter 12, keep in mind that this is near the very end of his life. It's approaching the last days just before his betrayal, arrest, and crucifixion. And during this time, Jesus has spent some time with the disciples and trying to prepare them for what's about to take place and carrying on in his place after he ascends up into heaven. And also grounding them in some important things as well. And he stresses most of all through this his purpose and his deity. Look at verse 23. John chapter 12, verse 23. And Jesus answered them, saying, "The hour is come, the Son of Man should be glorified." It was an appointed hour. As Galatians chapter 4, Paul tells us that in the fullness of time, God sent forth His Son, made of a woman, made under the law. An appointed time, before the foundation of the world, this was established, this was set by God. God's in control, folks. Verse 24, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit." In these next verses, he stresses the necessity of his death. Because without it, there is no fruit. "He that loveth his life shall lose it. And he that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal. If any man serve me, let him follow me. And where I am, there shall also my servant be. If any man serve me, him will my Father honor. Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this cause came I unto this hour." And there's a challenge in that for us as well. As he had a purpose, he had a calling. He's there for this hour. As the plan and purpose of God has come together in this fullness of time. And as Esther said, "Have I not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Christian, now is the time. Now is the time to get serious about praying for our leaders. Gary looked at the passage in 1 Timothy chapter 2 this morning in Sunday school, where we're to pray for kings and all that are authority over us, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. How faithfully have we prayed for Barack Obama? You say, well, I didn't vote for him. It didn't say anything about that. We got a responsibility, Christian, to pray for our leaders. Verse 28. Father, glorify thy name. Then came there a voice from heaven saying, I have both glorified it and I will glorify it again. The voice from heaven speaks. The people therefore that stood by heard it and said that it thundered. Others said an angel spake to him. Jesus answered and said, this voice came not because of me, but for your sakes. Now is the judgment of this world. Now shall the prince of this world be cast out. And I, if I be lifted up from earth, will draw all men unto me. This he said, signifying what death he should die. God's approval comes upon this thing. But look at verse 34. The people answered him, we have heard out of the law that Christ abideth forever. And how sayest thou the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man? Some skepticism and doubt still remains. Verse 35. Then said Jesus unto them, yet a little while is the light with you. There's a warning. Things are about to wrap up in this fullness of time, in this specific hour appointed by God, as things are going to really begin to pick up and change. And there's only a little time left. Walk while we have the light, lest darkness come upon you. For he that walketh in darkness knoweth not whither he goeth. While ye have the light, believe in the light that ye may be the children of light. These things spake Jesus, and departed, and did hide himself from them. But though he had done so many miracles before them, yet they believed not on him. As he stands before them, telling them, giving them some insight at least into what's about to take place. But he says, all that he'd done before, the turning of that water to wine at the marriage of Cana, the very first miracle that he performed, the many healings of the lame and the sick, the blind and the deaf, the raising of the dead, the feeding of the multitudes, and so many of these people had been personal eyewitnesses of many of these things. And yet they still didn't believe. And they're facing a judgment because of that. Yet they believe not. His ministry primarily was to Israel, at least to begin with. And you know, as we go through, and I want to just interrupt a minute here before we go back to this thing, but as we look at this text and we go back to Isaiah, there are many parallels between America and Israel. The problem is some mistakenly assume that they're equal. They're not. America is not Israel. It's separate and distinct from Israel. Israel occupies a very special, a very unique relationship with God. Israel is the nation of God's choosing, the apple of his eye, the one in whom all the promises of the Old Testament, the covenant with Abraham and so forth, all that rests on Israel. But because of the similarities, there are some theologians, the Reformed theologians, the replacement theologians, and the dominion theologians assume that America takes the place of Israel. And Christians take the place of Israel. That's false doctrine, folks. But that's influenced a lot of Christians' thinking and a lot of things. But these, nevertheless, there are some parallels between these two nations. And as we look at this morning, I want you to see some things here, because what Israel is about to face and their final rejection of their Messiah leads to probably the darkest period of time in the nation of Israel's history, a time of darkness which they still dwell in to this very day. And they went through some rough times. As we go back to Isaiah, he'll be leading up to the Babylonian captivity. But nothing to compare what they have experienced from the first century up till and through what's going to take place in the future now. The Holocaust is just one sample of what the Jews have faced because they believe not on him. In spite of all that he had done and everything that he had done to prove that he was who he claimed to be, they rejected him. America is unique. God's grace has shined upon us in the past. Oh, that it might again. That's where we come in, folks. It's not going to be about who's elected president. It's about God's people doing what we ought to do. Our founders were guided by biblical principles. They honored God. And I see nothing in the scriptures that proves America still exists in the end times. I'm not saying it doesn't. I just don't see any indication that we're at least figuring significantly into what takes place. Now that tells me that America changes before this thing all wraps up. Because right now, we are the significant nation of the world. And I attribute that to our Christian heritage. I mean, we're the nation that is a brother's keeper to the rest of the world. That's a biblical principle, folks. And there are so many other biblical principles that are a part of the very fabric of which this nation is made up. But we've drifted a long ways away from that. And that's the condition that Israel is here in the first century. They have drifted away from the God that had chose them. Look at verse 38, John chapter 12, verse 38. He spoke about them, the miracles, and them not believing on him because of them, that the saying of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spake. Lord, who hath believed our report? And to whom hath the arm of the Lord been revealed? Therefore they could not believe, because Isaiah said again, he hath blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, that they should not see with their eyes, nor understand with their heart, and be converted, and I should heal them. Israel got to the place where God turned against them. The apple of his eye, the people of his choosing, the ones that he said his grace would always shine upon them. His eye was always be looking to them, but they got to the place where God says, okay, you're cut off and you're set aside and you won't say. And they rejected Jesus Christ. When their sin and their hypocrisy is exposed, they refuse to humble themselves and repent. God says, okay, you're done. Their pride was wounded. They were offended at him. And they chose a thief, a murderer, an insurrectionist to be released from prison and cried for Jesus Christ to be crucified. Look at Matthew chapter 27. Matthew chapter 27, verse 15. This is the trial of Jesus Christ before Pilate. Now at the feast, the governor was wont to release unto the people a prisoner whom they would. Some tradition of theirs that as this part of the celebration, they could pick one prisoner to have set free. And they had them then a notable prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore, when they were gathered together, Pilate said unto them, Whom will ye that I release unto you, Barabbas or Jesus, which is called Christ? For he knew that for envy they had delivered them. Pilate's got it figured out. Man, I don't understand, but these guys hate this man so much. But here's an out. Here's an opportunity. Verse 19. When he was set down in the judgment seat, his wife sent unto him, saying, Have thou nothing to do with that just man? For I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him. But the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitude, or maybe that's the news media, persuaded the multitude, that they should ask Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor answered and said unto them, Whither of the twain will ye that I release unto you? They said, Barabbas. Pilate saith unto them, What shall I do then with Jesus, which is called Christ? They all say unto him, Let him be crucified. And the governor said, Why? What evil hath he done? But they cried the more, saying, Let him be crucified. When Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but for that rather a tumult was made, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. See you to it. He's just as guilty. He had power to release him. But he's swayed by the public opinion. Because he doesn't want to put his political position in jeopardy. So he goes through this motion of washing his hands and the whole mess. Watch this. Then answered all the people and said, His blood be upon us and on our children. They brought this curse upon themselves. And all that they have suffered from this point up until today and what they will suffer beyond until the end of the tribulation traces right back to here. His blood has been upon the people of Israel as a judgment for their rejection of him as their king. Go to Matthew chapter 23. Time and time again, God appealed to the people of Israel. Matthew chapter 23 puts us right with John chapter 12. These things took place maybe even the same day or at least within a few days of each other. As he's been appealing to the people, and in Matthew chapter 24, he begins talking about the end times and you know what shall be the sign of the times and so forth. Look at verse 23, chapter 23 and verse 30. And say if they had been in the days of our fathers. Well, verse 20, let's start there. Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous, and say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. They're claiming that they wouldn't have been a part of the atrocities committed against Jeremiah and Zechariah and many of the other Old Testament prophets, who were misused and abused because of their prophecies. We wouldn't have done that, they said. He says, oh yeah, you would. Verse 31, Wherefore ye be witnesses unto yourselves, that ye are the children of them which killed the prophets. Fill ye up then the measure of your fathers, ye serpents, ye generation of vipers. How can ye escape the damnation of hell? He said, look, you've rejected me. You've cast me off. You want nothing to do with me. And you're as guilty or worse of these you're condemning. Verse 34, wherefore, behold, I send to you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them you shall kill and crucify, and some of them you shall scourge in your synagogues and persecute them from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zacharias, the son of Barachias, whom ye slew between the temple and the altar. That covers the entire Old Testament. It takes you from Genesis chapter 5, where Cain slew Abel, up until, with the Jewish Bible ending with 2 Chronicles. The order of books is different than ours in the Jewish Bible. That takes you up to 2 Chronicles, the end of the Old Testament. He says, all the blood of the Old Testament is upon you. Verse 36, verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation. And as he stands up outside the city of Jerusalem, he says these words, looking down upon that city, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how oft would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, ye shall not see henceforth till ye shall say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. I'd have brought you back. I'd have accepted your repentance and pardoned you. But you wouldn't. And they hardened their hearts and they rejected him. Three things quickly I want us to consider, and paralleling Israel's condition and what I see as America's condition today. Go to Isaiah chapter 1 now. Isaiah chapter 1. As Jesus Christ stood outside the city of Jerusalem, looking down upon that city, he saw the wickedness of the people of Israel. Isaiah again brings us to the coming of the Assyrian captivity, taking the northern kingdom of Israel captive, and through that, and then also seeing what's to come later, 125 years later, when the Babylonians take the southern kingdom of Judah captive as well. And he begins here his prophecy in verse 2. He says, hear, O heavens, give ear, O earth, for the Lord hath spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox knoweth his owner, the ass his master's crib, but Israel doth not know. My people doth not consider. Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors. They have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger. They are gone away backward. The Lord saw the sinfulness of the nation of Israel as Isaiah saw it. They rebelled, they forsook, and they provoked him. They had a heritage, a rich heritage, but that wouldn't sustain them for the future. And Christian, we can look back and all the blessings of God upon this nation and all the times of divine intervention on behalf of our nation that allowed us to be where we are today, but that's not going to sustain us tomorrow. That righteousness needs to be there now. And it's not. And while we are not personally guilty of some of the wickedness of our land, it's still part of our land. And the blood cries out for the innocent blood cries out from the land, the Bible tells us. 3,000 babies killed every day through abortion. And one candidate and the party that she represents stands for abortion. One party stands against it. Not as strongly as we'd like at times, but at least the attempt is made. That's one of our choices, folks. One party stands for homosexuality and gay rights and the dissolving of traditional marriage. One party stands for it. One party 4 years ago in their platform, as they were making a vote on it, rejected God from their platform. And let me say this, I heard that. And it wasn't the choice of the people. It was the choice of the leadership. In spite of the voice of the people crying against what they were doing, the leadership chose to erase God from their platform. The wickedness of this land is great. Look at chapter 2, verse 6. Therefore thou hast forsaken thy people, the house of Jacob, because they be replenished from the east, and are soothsayers like the Philistines, and they please themselves in the children of strangers. They've looked to other places for their help, for their needs, instead of God. They replenish themselves from the east. Verse 7, their land also is full of silver and gold. Neither is there any end of their treasures. Their land is also full of horses. Neither is there any end of their chariots. Their land also is full of idols. They worship the work of their own hands, that which their own fingers have made. Now that's the definition of an idol. If I were to fashion something up here and set it up here and said this is our icon, that would be the fashioning of mine own hands. But Christian, let's think about this maybe in a little more applicable way. Sometimes we worship what we do. Maybe we don't have that statue, that idol sitting up there, but it's the product of mine own labors. The work of my own hands, the work of my own fingers, that which mine own fingers have made, he said. That gets a little closer to home, doesn't it? And the mean man boweth down, and the great man humbled himself. Therefore, forgive them not. Some trust in chariots, some in horses, Proverbs 21:31. But we are to remember the name of the Lord our God. And some people have looked to the conservative movement, or the Libertarian Party, or other things as being our salvation instead of looking to the God, our Creator, the work of our own hands. They sought everywhere but God for help. And they were unmindful of His blessing. Look at chapter 5. Isaiah chapter 5. Now I will sing to my beloved a song of my beloved touching his vineyard. My well-beloved hath a vineyard in a very fruitful hill. And the vineyard here is several places in Isaiah and Jeremiah is a picture of Israel. How God took this land, this undeveloped land, and He cleaned it, and he cultivated it, and He plowed it up, and He planted the seeds, and He did all the things to care for that, and he built that fence around about that land. That's what He did to the nation of Israel. He took Abraham out of the Ur of the Chaldees, and He put him into that land of Canaan. And He says, walk through it, Abraham. Look at it all. Wherever you go, it's all going to be yours and passed on to your seed, if you'll just obey me. And when it came time for them to conquer that land after the Egyptian captivity, God went before them, driving out those inhabitants. And he said, nobody can stand against you. All that he did to cultivate and protect the nation of Israel is what's in view here. Verse 2, and he fenced it and gathered out the stones thereof and planted it with the choicest vine and built a tower in the midst of it and also made a winepress therein. And he looked that it should bring forth grapes. And it brought forth wild grapes. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I pray you, betwixt me and my vineyard. What could I have done more to my vineyard that I have not done in it? Wherefore, when I looked that it should bring forth grapes, brought it forth wild grapes. The Lord said, what else could I have done? I've done everything for this people. And yet when I came expecting the good fruit, I get this mutation. These wild grapes. Folks, God protected America. We should not have won the Revolutionary War. Everything was against us except the most important, God. Amen. And if God be for us, who can be against us, the Bible says. God was for us. Because we were with him. But folks, we're not anymore. And sad to say, even we, his people, are not as with him as we ought to be. And we're not looking to him and trusting in him and being mindful of all the blessings and the benefits that we've received his hand. He saw the sinfulness of his nation. And we are at this point now. Is it a crossroads? I don't know. But it could be. At this tipping point, possibly. Because we've separated ourselves from God. We have forsaken him. Even as his people in some ways. The sinfulness of his nation. Secondly, he saw the destruction of his nation. Look at verse 5 of chapter 5. I now go to, I tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away the hedge thereof, and it shall be eaten up. And break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down. And I will lay it waste, it shall not be pruned nor digged, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is a house of Israel, and the men of Judah his pleasant plant. And he looked for judgment, but behold oppression, for righteousness, but behold a cry. Woe unto them that join house to house, that lay field to field, till there be no place that they may be placed alone in the midst of the earth. In mine ears, said the Lord of hosts, of a truth many houses shall be desolate, even great and fair, without inhabitant. Yea, 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath. And the seed of an omer shall yield an ephah. Greatly declined productivity. The thing that I'm familiar with is wheat. When the farmers out in Kansas go out and they sow the seed in the winter time or in the fall, September, they plant about 3/4 of a bushel per acre of wheat. Their hope is to get at least about 50 or 60 bushels in return. Now, what's that, about a 75% yield, something like that? Roughly. Sometimes they get 100. Sometimes they get 20. You think, whoa, 20 after only 3/4. That doesn't pay the bills, folks. And that's about what you got here. Maybe even less. With the omer bringing an ephah. It produces something, but not near enough to be productive. That's the condition that God's speaking about the nation of Israel being for forsaking him. Verse 11, woe unto them that rise up early in the morning See if this doesn't describe America today. And follow after strong drink that continue until night, till wine inflame them. And the harp, and the vial, and the tabret, and the pipe, and wine are in their feasts, and they regard not the work of the Lord, neither consider the operation of His hands. It's party time! And everything is an excuse to get drunk. God condemns that. Therefore, my people are gone into captivity. Because they have not have no knowledge, and their honorable men are famished, and their multitude dried up with thirst. Therefore hell hath enlarged herself, and opened her mouth without measure. I know I've used this verse before, but I don't think I've ever really pointed it out in the context. The condition is so bad, God says, that hell has to be expanded. Hell hath enlarged herself and opened her mouth without measure, and their glory and their multitude and their pomp, and he that rejoiceth shall descend into it. That's what God allowed to the people that was the apple of his eye, the nation of his choosing. Where's that put us, folks? At some point, God's going to do as he did with Israel to America. And allow, it's already started. Oh, we can't keep the Muslims out. That would be targeting, profiling. Well, how many of the terrorists have not been a Muslim? Oh, but that's unfair. Okay, so just go ahead and blow up my kids. That's insane, folks. You wouldn't do that in your home. Somebody's a potential threat to your home, you're not going to let them in. Amen. Till you verify. We just lost our minds as a nation. And Isaiah saw the destruction of that nation. Look at chapter 2, verse 19. And they shall go into the holes of the rocks and the caves of the earth for the fear of the Lord and for the glory of His majesty when He riseth to shake terribly the earth. At that day a man shall cast his idols of silver, his idols of gold, which they made each one for himself to worship, to the moles and to the bats. To go into the clefts of the rocks and the tops of the ragged rocks for fear of the Lord, for the glory of His majesty when He ariseth to shake the earth terribly. And you could go to chapter 3, verses 24 to 26, and on and on. But in Isaiah chapter 60 and verse 12, it says the nations built, well, I better read it because I'm not going to quote it right. Isaiah 60 and verse 12. For the nation and kingdom that will not serve thee shall perish. Yea, those nations shall be utterly wasted. I don't know where God draws the line. But folks, I fear we're getting close. If we haven't crossed it already. God says, you won't serve me? Okay, you'll perish. Utterly wasted. And the fact that I can't find the United States of America anywhere in the scriptures concerns me. I don't know how it's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen. But I fear it's coming. He saw the destruction. Lastly this, Isaiah chapter 6. He saw the Lord. Isaiah had revealed to him all of this coming destruction for the nation of Israel. First to the northern kingdom. Then to follow after 100 by 125 years. And he saw the north carried captive. He did not live to see the South, but it came as he prophesied. Because the South didn't learn the lesson of what happened to the North. They weren't paying attention. And they saw all these things, just like the people in Jesus' day that saw all those miracles. Yet they believed not. They believed not enough to change their ways and live and honor and glorify God. Isaiah chapter 6, verse 1. Isaiah says, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord sitting upon the throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple." God showed him some very terrible things, some things that struck fear into his heart. And then God showed him this. "This is coming, Isaiah, but I want you to see me. God in the heavens, high, lifted up. His train filled that temple." Now, I can't even begin to adequately describe, because I don't even fully understand all of this. But this just caused Isaiah to fall on his face. The sight that he saw. God in all of his glory sitting upon the throne. Verse 2. "Above it stood the seraphims. Each one had six wings. With twain he covered his face. With twain he covered his feet. With twain he did fly. And one cried unto another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the posts of the door moved at the voice of him that cried. And the house was filled with smoke." I mean, can you imagine that? We hear maybe a sonic boom. Of course, you don't hear them anymore, do you? Remember when they come through and just the house would shake? This is heaven. A little bit stronger foundation than what we got here, isn't it? And yet still, this cry of these angelic beings shakes the posts in heaven. And the smoke fills the temple up there. And Isaiah gets to see it. God in all of his glory. The God that's in control. And the God at whose feet we need to fall and beg for his mercy on our country. Verse 5. "Then said I, Woe is me, for I'm undone. Because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Folks say, "I can't vote for Donald Trump. The things that he's supposedly done, if he did them." And I don't doubt that he didn't do some of those things. But folks, we're not voting on God. You're not even voting on a pastor. You're voting on a president. Look, I'm not perfect. Can you imagine if any one of us were to run for president, to have your entire life looked at through the microscope that those lives are looked at? I dare say there's not a person in here that doesn't have some things we hope nobody ever finds out about. Isaiah, "I'm a man of unclean lips. I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips." You're always voting for the least of two evils. Because Jesus Christ isn't on the ballot. You got to vote for what's best for the country. Vote against abortion, sodomy, open borders, a disastrous fiscal policy, Obamacare. You know, I know there's some claim Trump made a profession of faith. I don't know what to do with that. I can't say one way or the other. I hope he did. don't see a lot of evidence. But you know what? In my lifetime, of course this came about in my lifetime, but I don't remember anybody proposing a repeal of the Johnson Amendment. Right. Trump has. You know what the Johnson Amendment says? I can go to jail for endorsing a candidate from the pulpit. Now, it's never been enacted, but he wants to repeal that. George Bush was a Christian. I believe that. I've read his book. He says, heard his testimony. He never called for that. But Trump has. Again, maybe he's just throwing us a bone. I don't know. But there's a chance. He saw this. And he was flattened by his sinfulness. Verse 9. And he said, the voice speaking to Isaiah, go and tell this people, hear ye indeed, but understand not. See indeed, but perceive not. Make the heart of this people fat. Make their ears heavy. Shut their eyes, lest they should see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and convert, be healed. Man, what a ministry. Go ahead, Isaiah, but it's not going to amount to anything because they're not going to listen. But what he saw caused him to go nevertheless. At personal risk to himself and stand before kings and before the religious leaders and proclaim the truth that God had revealed to him. Verse 11, then said I, Lord, how long? And he answered, until the cities be waxed, wasted without inhabitant, and the houses without man, and the land be utterly desolate, and the Lord have removed men far away, and there be a great forsaking in the midst of the land. You just keep doing it. Even after it's proved futile. And he did. Christian, we quit too easy. And I don't care who's elected Tuesday. The worst thing we can do is say, oh, we got who we wanted. No. That's the worst thing we could do. We need to keep up. Because it's not the person in the White House. It's your family. It's your neighbor. It's your coworker. And we've got a responsibility to take the gospel of Jesus Christ to them. Because that's what's wrong with America. It's not the Democrats. It's not the Republicans. It's the lost. Because the church has failed to do what she's supposed to do.
Amen.
And we fail to pray for our leaders like the Word of God commands us to do. Christian, it's our responsibility. But who we elect Tuesday is going to choose some Supreme Court justices. Do you want a Sotomayor, a Kagan, or Ginsburg? Or do you want someone in lines of Scalia and Thomas? Trump said who he's going to nominate. Looks like a pretty good list of... Again, we can't count on him following through, but I know what she's going to do. And ultimately, the lot is cast in the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. Christian, we need to pray. We've been challenged to fast and pray for this upcoming election. And I would say we need to continue thereon afterwards as well. for our sakes, for our children's sakes, for our grandchildren's sakes. Because someday, this thing's going to be destroyed. And what a shame if we stand before the judgment seat of Christ and find out that because I failed in some way, because I refused to act in some way, I contributed to the downfall of this great nation of ours. So what can I do? One person. Isaiah is just one. Read verse 13. But yeah, in it shall be a tenth. And it shall return and shall be eaten as a teal tree and as an oak whose substance is in them. When they cast their leaves, so the holy seed shall be the substance thereof. There's a remnant. And we can have an influence on that. And we need to. I'd like you to stand, please. I want to do something different for our invitation this morning. As I was working on this message last night, I was listening. I had the internet radio on in the background, the Baptist Radio Network, and there was a song by Lester Roloff that came on, and he started explaining about the missionary that this song was about. So I turned it up to be able to listen to that, to hear it. And I didn't turn it down right away, and this next song came on. A song by Amber Miller. Turn the Tide. I'm not going to try to sing it this morning, but as I read these words, if God spoken to you this morning, the altar's open, this is our invitation, you come and pray and listen to the words of this song. When America was founded, she was strong and pure and good, and her leaders on their knees were not ashamed to call on God. But our nation in her pride has turned her back upon the right. And the clouds of evil threaten to turn glory into night. Strong wickedness has crept in like a cold and bloody thief. Those who know the Lord and do His word stand by in disbelief. For the love of God and country, we must not cease for a day. For the future of our children, we must lift our hearts and pray. Turn the tide, Lord, turn the tide. Open wide the floodgates of your power. Stem the flood of wickedness. Restore, revive, and bless. Turn the tide. God's enemy is hard at work, undermining everywhere, breaking down foundations, twisting laws, and setting snares. He would take away our freedom and replace it with despair. And he laughs at those opposing him as if they were not there. But God's children cannot sit by. We must stand up and defend. For the battle is not over till our King declares the end. We must work and fight and meet him, not as those who beat the air. For the greatest weapon in our hands is strong and fervent prayer. Though the waves of immorality may beat upon the shore, and it seems that all ungodliness is knocking at our door, we must never give up hope. We must not let them win the war. We must plead with Him who has the power to cleanse and to restore. Restore, Lord, turn the tide. Turn the tide. Open wide the floodgates of your power. Stem the flood of wickedness. Restore, revive, and bless. Turn the tide. Turn the tide.